Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So my Columbus Day surprise did happen.
It sure did. It didn't happen during the time you thought during the parade. It happened after the parade in Stone Park. Ron Onesti, you know, he's the Joint Civic Committee President of the Italian Americans. He unveiled the
also
statue.
Also involved with the Italian American National Sports Hall of Fame.
Yeah. He's a great guy.
They allowed us to take it, to fix it. The Park District realized that and how hurt we were, and they allowed us to take it, to fix it.
So there was graffiti on it, so they cleaned it up, and now today they have to bring it back.
It was a one-day furlough.
It was in a Chicago Park District warehouse. So it was good to see it again, and people were so excited.
Is it really to honor indigenous people, or is it just to dishonor Columbus? There's 364 other opportunities. Why must it be on our day?
Because it was a big deal that, you know, people are having dual events in Chicago. So you had the Columbus Day Parade, and then down, I think it was in Wicker Park, they had an Indigenous Peoples Day event.
Was Joe Biden in attendance?
No, he was not in attendance, mm-hmm. No. And neither were Mayor Lightfoot and Governor Pritzker. They both released statements pretty much
celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day.
Yeah, and not mentioning at all about, obviously... here's what they wrote. Mayor Daley. Today we honor the Mayor Daley, Mayor Lightfoot. Today we honor the culture of the indigenous people and their contributions to our society, blah, blah, blah. Simultaneously, we must also reckon with the difficult history and legacy of Christopher Columbus.
What is that? Yeah. First of all, of course, she issued that statement because she tore down the statue. What else can she say after that display, number one? And number two, when you make a statement like that, you know, this difficult history must reckon with things generically. No. Specifically. You tell me what your understanding of the history is so that we can have a debate on the specifics. You don't get to just wave it off and say, well, you do because there's no Chicago Press Corps worth a rat's behind. But... you don't just get to wait. Difficult history. Oh, it's this stylized history, this invented history, this stilted history. No, you shouldn't get away with that. And good for Ron Onesti and those that reassembled for the Columbus Day Parade, despite what happened last year, to basically set the record straight and set the statue right, at least in Stone Park, if not downtown.
Yeah, and Governor Pritzker, who, you know, both he and Lightfoot march in this parade every year. Okay, he sat this year out too, tweeting, long before it was the state we call home, Illinois belonged to the Illini, Miami, Winnebago, Sauk, and other indigenous civilizations. On Indigenous Peoples Day, take time to learn about the history of this land, from Starved Rock to whatever.
You first. Yeah. You gelatinous tub of goo marching in a parade. That's a physical impossibility. And you first, triple threat. But to tell me about Christopher Columbus. I want to hear it.
Oh, yeah.
I want to hear people who, you know, give you that established Howard Zinn talking point talk at length about Christopher Columbus's history and the history of America as they understand it. See, the problem that we have, it seems to me, is you get away with these press releases like these politicians, and you get away, if you're just a regular rank-and-file leftist, you get away with just repeating a line or two from those press releases at a cocktail party and sounding like you know what the hell you're talking about, and you don't. So, for example, tell me when Christopher Columbus Day was established as a federal national holiday. When did that happen? Why did it happen? Do you know what the backdrop was? Tell me about Christopher Columbus's objective when he set out for the New World? Tell me, what was it? Search for gold? Is that what you think? Reflect on Christopher Columbus's writing about the maltreatment of natives by some of his crew members. What was his view?
Those are
because
great
obviously
questions.
Obviously these are people that are very familiar with a scholarship on the topic. They're very familiar with, for example, Carol Delaney's work. She's a cultural anthropologist, PhD from University of Chicago. Very familiar with her work on the subject, right? So, you know, distinguish your views and your understanding of history from, say, cultural anthropologist Carol Delaney's. There's a conversation ender. These people are empty-headed, one-dimensional, talking points automatons. And I'm talking about the politicians, and I'm talking about your rank-and-file leftists that you can spin the wheel and pick a leafy suburb and pull them out of whatever Starbucks is located downtown.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Here's what they were saying at the Indigenous People Celebration yesterday, which I counted. There were about maybe 20 people there.
For over 500 years, Indigenous people have been fighting for their survival, their land, and their rights. And each October, when Columbus is honored, it further diminishes and erases Native people, their history, and their culture.
Does it really do that?
Well, again, how does it do that?
How? Yeah.
How, it's just a declarative statement. Explain to me how it does that. You and half a dozen people are on the network affiliate newscasts because of the leftist bent of the media in big cities to, you know, plead your case. So plead it. How is your heritage or your history being diminished by an understanding of additional history and additional peoples who have a different country of origin? This is a zero-sum game. If you're honoring a person from one country, then you can't honor people from other countries. You can't, if you're honoring one representative of one ethnicity, you can't honor another representative of another ethnicity. I mean, how grade school is this stuff?
I know. And November
is that complicated?
No. November 1st is the first day of American Indian Heritage Month. So they want to, you know, they're so upset by Christopher Columbus, they want to steal that holiday and pretend that he never existed. They don't want those statues to go back up.
All these holidays and all these heritage months, this is what this is.
It's a new America.
These are balkanizing leftists dressed up as vanguards of their culture and their history and America's history by extension. They're frauds. In point of fact, I mean, just so you people don't know, maybe know, share. Lynchings, an ignominious part of our nation's history, often associated only with black Americans, slaves and black Americans. It was the lynching of 11 Italian Americans in 1891 that gave rise to the installation of Columbus Day. A year later, President Benjamin Harrison. Do you know that? Of course not. Columbus set sail for the New World to spread Christianity. Yes, the crown wanted him to search for treasure too, but it was to spread Christianity. In point of fact, as I mentioned yesterday when we discussed this, Columbus spoke negatively and in a chastising manner about the the crimes against humanity, really, of some of those who sailed with him. But this is the same person who consorted with Franciscan monks and even took Franciscan monks on his second voyage because he was a man who tried to live out his faith, however imperfectly as he did. That's the fact. That's the history.
Well, one politician yesterday who made sense was Alderman Spezzato, who was in the parade.
Check history. A little bit more research on it. It was 500 years ago.
that's not making sense. I'm sorry, that's not good enough either. That's a generic reference to saying I disagree with your character. I'm going to offer my generic characterization of history in response to your generic characterization of history. Specific questions that indicate knowledge and force a response on the specifics. If you want to have a productive conversation, if you want to trade mindless talking points, then you can go be a reporter for any of the news stations in Chicago.
Well, the Cook County Commissioner, Brandon Johnson, he wants to eliminate this holiday and says people should get back to work and not have a paid day off.
We are literally paying people to take a day off to honor someone who's responsible for mass genocide.
Yeah, right. Another talking point clown. But I'm sure all the city employees enjoy their paid vacation day.
Oh, yeah. None of
them. Greg in Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Listen, these leftists, I mean, they don't get, like, what you were saying about, like, you have a little conversation about the truth and discuss things. It can never happen with these leftists. They take and they avoid the facts, they hide the facts, they hide the truth, they lie about everything, spin everything around, they make up their own damn facts, whatever they want to say about anything. And this doesn't just apply to this, it applies to everything. That's why you can never get anywhere with these people, and that's why. What you're saying, it's just,
go ahead. Thanks for the call, Craig. Well, yes, that's true, but we also need to be better. Go check your history is not good enough. The, you know, they can have their own day. That's not good enough. We're not talking about them. We're talking about us. That's what Anesti should have said. We're talking about us. We're talking about a historical figure that is meaningful, not just to Italian Americans, but it's meaningful in the context of America's history and the West's history. And so let's get it right. And let's review it warts and all, like we do every aspect of American history, including this utopia that the left is attempting to impose on us in 21st century America. Well, in 20th century America, too, spilling over into 21st century America. This will be recorded, too, and it'll have to be discussed warts and all. That's the approach that we should take. Be specific. Read. Be knowledgeable so you can impart knowledge, and then maybe we can spread wisdom rather than refrigerator magnet aphorisms.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We were talking about Columbus Day a little bit and the history of Christopher Columbus after yesterday's Columbus Day events in Chicago, particularly the parade and the unveiling of the statue that was felled by Mayor Triple Threat and taken out of Grand Park and reemerged after it got cleaned up by Ron Onesti and the Joint Civic Committee for Italian Americans in Chicago and erected in Stone Park, at least for a day. One day furlough from the Chicago Park District. We'll have to find out because it's a matter of litigation what ultimately is the fate of that statue, but at least it was public view for one day.
Yeah, and it was because of that litigation that they were able to take it out, clean it up, and now they have to put it back. But they got to take it on a special day to the Italian Americans.
So and so them. We had race-based fascists, the Ku Klux Klan, in the 1920s and 30s, trying to prevent and disrupt Columbus Day celebrations, trying to prevent states like Oregon from instituting Columbus Day as a state holiday. And so we have race-based fascists today doing the same thing. The new race-based fascists. 100 years ago, it was the KKK. Today, it's politicians like identitarian politicians like Triple Threat and Spalding. There's no difference. No difference. They don't need to use the street violence of the KKK because they have a monopoly of force as elected officials.
Well, them plus Antifa.
Think about that.
Yeah.
And so while we're rewriting American history, trying to usher in the new America, the vision of the left, we're going to need a new flag. We're going to need we got to the new anthem, the Black National Anthem.
There's It's only one national anthem.
We're going to need a new flag, too. Oh, maybe this could be a Bill Maher commentary. There's only one flag. Maybe people can run around saying there's only one flag and feel like they're really striking a blow against the left and for freedom. They're really protecting America. There should only be one anthem. There should only be one flag, as if mouthing those words is so important. You're really taking the fight to the left, aren't you? Meanwhile, they press on, don't they? New York Times, over the weekend, contracted with an artist to come up with half a dozen new renderings of the American flag for consideration. Oh. Now, of course, it's a little difficult to properly describe those. I tweeted out a New York Times piece at Dan Proft if you want to take a look and peruse the offerings. Give you a description. So simply put, isn't it time for a new American flag to reflect this enlightened age in which we live, where we're submitting to leftist revolutionaries to redefine America's past as well as its present? We're going to need a new flag for that, aren't we? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. I like this one.
Which one?
It's the American flag that just looks like a blur. It's the actual American flag, the stars and stripes, but it's essentially blurred out. So you just see like a splotch of blue in the upper left-hand corner and then a light red throughout. You can't make out anything else. And this is such a wonderful interpretation. The artist commissioned by the New York Times, the familiar symbolism falls out of focus, giving way to something ambiguous, vague, and difficult to define.
I love what you tweeted. Why not just go with the traditional white flag of surrender?
That's what this is.
Yeah, that's what it is. We're surrendering to the mob, and to the woke, to the idiots. Do they even know what the stars and the flag mean?
One
for each state.
Another offering I'm fascinated by. I assume this will be an exhibit at the Art Institute at some point, so you can go to the Art Institute with your mask on, as long as you've been vaccinated, and you can stare into these works to really extract all the texture and nuance. A monochrome flag with just stars on it. The monochrome shows how America is surrendering to its fall from power and the loss of ideals it once stood for. And by the way, the left is in complete agreement with that interpretation of where America's at. No less than the MSNBC vaudeville act of Joy Reid and former CIA director John Brennan on the fall of our democracy. Joy Reid can't sleep at night because our democracy is unwinding into a monochrome flag.
Joining me now is John Brennan, former CIA director, and Olivia Troy, former senior aide on the White House Coronavirus Task Force and director of the Republican Accountability Project. Director Brennan, I suffer from insomnia, and one of the things that has made it worse is that I cannot stop thinking about this. You know, I feel like, you know, that people are sort of going about their lives and not facing the fact that our democracy really is falling into a deep sinkhole. And I don't know if you, having professionally had to look at countries that were spiraling out of democracy into autocracy, if you see us lining up the way that those countries lined up on their way down.
Well, I do, Joy. And over the last several years, I think we have all exhausted all the words and phrases in the English language to describe the moral bankruptcy of the leading members of the Republican Party, including, of course, Donald Trump. And I think each day we have more evidence of that bankruptcy. And it's not just their rhetoric that we should be concerned about. I think they really are laying the groundwork for the elections in 2022 and 2024. Their whole party platform these days is based on dishonesty. They continue to try to exploit those fears and concerns of a lot of American citizens. And they're hoping that with their dishonest ways, they're going to be able to sway them with this big lie.
Mm-hmm. Misdirection through projection. They're working overtime. The lower Biden's poll numbers get, the more you're going to hear from the Joy Reads and the John Brennans reading from their scripts and projecting onto conservatives their disposition philosophically and their, well, I won't say crimes, but let's just say misdeeds, rhetorical and otherwise, in the case of Brennan, otherwise, about who is telling the truth, who has America's best interests in focus and so forth. Maybe, you know, a new symbol would help, like a new American flag.
Oh, yeah, and the old American flag can go in the cancel culture history museum that you and I are going to create.
Well, the old American flag.
To put
flag,
all these
I mean,
old items in, people can see what really happened in this country.
Well, how can you tolerate the current American flag if you can't tolerate the current national anthem, if that's not a unifying symbol, as it were, the song, if the flag is not, this flag can't be a unifying symbol. And frankly, I mean, how much different is the current American flag from the Confederate flag? You ask that question on MSNBC, you know what the answer you're going to get is?
What?
It's not. That's the answer you're going to get.
Really?
It's not any different because, of course, this American flag we currently salute was born out of the same racist, genocidal monster who discovered the West, that would be Columbus, and then, of course, our racist, slave-owning founding fathers and America's original sin of racism wired into our DNA. I mean, you just go right into the Nicole Hannah Jones 1619 Project script.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
They don't have anything to offer in terms of competence or, you know, vision for a robust, free society, opportunity-based and free. So what do they offer? They offer shame. You shall repeat these words. You shall surrender this and that. You shall pay for this and that. Otherwise, you're a racist. And they believe that they can, along with their p-hat-wearing suburban allies, p-hat-wearing, overeducated, under-talented suburban allies, can cower enough people to win an election. That's the strategy.
And they act so proud, too, of their bad behavior.
Well, that's the strategy. It's state dependence. Mm-hmm. And those racists who like state dependents to abort their children, you know who I'm talking about. I'm talking about basically overeducated white women and a lot of the male impersonators they married in on the North Shore, in River Forest,
Hinsdale.
In Hinsdale, in Naperville, and Glen Ellen. That's what I'm talking about. You know who they are.
I know.
That is the wedge in their army. And they drag the state dependents who've been buffaloed by their real concern for their plight along with them. And that's who they're counting on. That's all they have. So it will be nonstop, 24/7, rewriting and shaming, rewriting and shaming, misdirecting through projecting to shame, to facilitate their rewrite. That's what they've been doing on a small scale for really 100 years, but in particularly the last 60. And now it's at breakneck speed.
Yeah, it's a breakneck. And they cancel people. They cancel history. They go after stars. They go after football players and coaches and everything. Cancel it all.
And why wouldn't they? Because they've realized more or less nothing but success. Except during the Trump years to some extent.
Wait till it happens to them because it's going to happen to them.
Otherwise, over the last four decades really, maybe with the exception to some extent of the Reagan years and the exception to some extent of the Trump years, they've been putting a lot of points on the board. So why would they stop? Thus, the Black National Anthem at NFL games. Did you see that coming 5 years ago? The New York Times, the Gray Lady, the paper of record, proposing a half a dozen new designs for the American flag. Did you see that coming?
No, never in my lifetime would I ever think that that would happen.
Mike in Littleton, Colorado.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. Just real quick maintenance. I believe the other bet you had with Amy was that Andrew Cuomo would resurface and run again, and I went in on that because I think he will, and he'll win. And the other thing I wanted to say is
I'll take that action.
I find it interesting.
Go on, sorry.
I find it very interesting that people who accomplish nothing in life, they don't even have the brains or ambition to change a tire, can, you know, make condescension about a guy, Christopher Columbus, who, you know, sailed looking for trade routes to India in a wooden boat with no navigation. And, you know, in 500 years, in retrospect, they judge him. I mean, these people are useless.
For the call, Mike. Well, we don't elevate people who accomplish things. Unless you're in front of a camera. So if you're an athlete or an actor, and then we elevate people who just sit in front of a camera and blather on ignorantly because you're in front of a camera. So this is the social influencer era in America. We went from the celebrity culture to now everybody's a celebrity. So you have to be in front of a camera or a phone, which is the same thing. That's the way that you are an important person, not what you do substantively, not what you offer intellectually. It's what sort of public profile you have. And you could not have an interesting thing to say, and so many people, including, by the way, on the center right, don't have an interesting thing to say. Mouth some of the words, haven't read the books, haven't thought much about much. That's the culture today.
Got a text message, Ron and Berwin. When guys like me and much smarter people were warning the banning of the Confederate battle flag would eventually lead to the banning of the Stars and Stripes, you guys, Nikki Haley, were brushing us off as just stupid racists. Well, here we are, as I predicted.
First of all, that's not what we did. And Ron and Berwin is a little race obsessed for my tastes. So nice try. But don't rewrite. You're not going to rewrite American history on the show, and you're not going to rewrite the history of at least my position on this show. So that's actually not what happened, Ron and Berwin. But nice try. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy talking about the designs that are under consideration by the New York Times and thus must be by all of America for a new American flag in the new America. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Yeah, well, as a history teacher, one of the things that I can tell you is over the 20th century, the road from useful idiot to useless eater is a short one. So, you know, we better get our history right and know what's up with these people and all these different changes they want to do, because that's where it's going. So those who want to support these strange people with their strange ideas, I'm telling you, that's where it's going.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Yeah, I mean, they're not strange ideas. They've been tried over and over again, and they pile up a big body count when implemented by the state. David in Lansing.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I have an idea for a new American flag. It's separated into five parts. In the upper left is a Chinese flag. Upper right is a crack pipe, and it says equals Antifa. Lower left, it says BLM with a hammer and sickle. And then the lower right, it's a rainbow. And then in the very middle, it's a American flag upside down with 51 stars. The 51st star is kind of like drawn in there by pencil. And that represents Puerto Rico, the 51st state. What do you think?
I thought you were going to go D.C., but okay. All right. Thanks for the call, yeah. David. I think you could have an entrance an exhibit at this showing, I'm sure, that the New York Times will host for this artist they commissioned to come up with these renderings for consideration. So look forward to that. Probably maybe the undercard in the Hunter Biden art gala.
Oh, that's
scheduled.
Right.
How about that?
And then people forget about Betsy Ross, too.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So L.A. Raiders, well, not, excuse me, Las Vegas Raiders head coach John Gruden, Chucky as he's known, resigns late last night over his performance against the Bears on Sunday. No, it wasn't that, although that was worthy of a resignation, but particularly on offense. But rather over emails going back as far as 2011, in which he used colorful language to describe, well, Roger Goodell, Joe Biden, the former, or I guess current NFL Players Association executive.
Yeah, that was stupid. It was a dumb email. It was insensitive. It was wrong. Should he have lost his job over it from 10 years ago? I don't know.
NFLPA Executive Director DeMaurice Smith is who I'm referring to. And then also references to Jeff Fisher, the head of the Rams, being allegedly pressured by Roger Goodell to draft Michael Sam, the first gay player that was taken, the last pick a few years ago. Didn't pan out for Michael Sam in the NFL, but regardless, he used the F word to describe a gay person. And so there was this investigation going on into his correspondence, and so now he's gone.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. He released a statement, "I have resigned as head coach of the Las Vegas Raiders. I love the Raiders and do not want to be a distraction. Thank you to all the players, coaches, staff, and fans of Raider Nation. I'm sorry. I never meant to hurt anyone."
Well, I never meant to hurt him. I mean, you know, obviously you meant to hurt people that you have no respect for. I mean, or maybe not hurt them, but, you know, describe them in unvarnished terms. You call Roger Goodell an F word? That's fireable. Goodell should not have pressured then St. Louis Rams coach Jeff Fisher to draft queers, referring to the pick of Michael Sam in 2014. LGBTQ, isn't that what they call them? So, some, is that not right? I can't keep up with the nomenclature. Emails also contain anti-trans conversations that mock Caitlyn Jenner, and another that made what the Journal describes as an anti-gay joke about Tampa Bay Bucks owner Brian Glazer. Gruden and some of the participants, per this investigation, shared photos of topless women, oh my gosh, including at least one Washington football team cheerleader. Other emails included more anti-gay language. Gruden also wrote that Eric Reed, a player on the Redskins, don't call them the Redskins, Washington football team, a player kneeled during the national anthem to protest, should be fired. The emails presented to Goodell last week as part of the NFL's investigation that were shared with the Raiders and condemned by the NFL. And then a few days later, as this broke over the weekend into this week, he gone. And we're talking about somebody who's, you know, of a high-profile coach. I mean, he's a Super Bowl-winning coach with the Bucks. I mean, with the Raiders. With the Bucks.
No,
with the Raiders. The Raiders beat the Bucks, right? Yeah. Wasn't that like 2001?
He was with Tampa Bay forever. And then did, and football analysis, worked at ESPN. And there's looking into those emails as well. But he's just the beginning. If he's in trouble, Dan, there's going to be a lot of NFL teams without head coaches.
Maybe. I mean, I have no idea. But I do know that if using the P word to describe a man, if that is
insensitive,
a career ender for a football coach, then yeah, you're right. There's going to be a lot of openings for football coaches. Maybe some of those P hats that march on the mall annually. Like the viewers of The View, maybe they can take over NFL franchises and roam the sidelines instead of John Gruden. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-360-A, turnkey.pro, text line.
Yeah, and he did win a Super Bowl championship when he was coaching the Bucks, and they faced the Raiders, right, and won 48-21 victory.
Yeah, right, okay, yeah, all right. I know my memory wasn't failing me that badly. you know, a career ender, these comments. By the way, he also called Joe Biden, when he was vice president, a nervous, clueless p-hat, which... Is that inaccurate?
No, that's not inaccurate. And why is that a fireable offense?
Isn't
he doesn't have a right to free speech?
Isn't the truth an absolute defense to defamation? Yeah, again, using the P word to describe men in particular.
We do that all the time on this show.
Well, I mean, I say P hat.
P hat, right, because you can't say the other.
Well, that's all Qurans, too. I mean, and because their wives wear P hats, and so do the... You know, women they're married to.
I saw, real quick, ancillary issue. I saw a pea hat guy yesterday because it poured here. We had a horrible storm. Wearing a mask outside, and his mask was completely soaking wet. I'm like, don't think you're going to get the vid in hurricane force winds there, buddy.
Roger Goodell is a clueless anti-football pea hat. Joe Biden is a nervous, clueless pea hat. Demaryius Smith, he described as like Michelin lips.
Yeah, horrible.
But Gruden said, look, I call people rubber lips. I call people who are lying rubber lips.
Oh.
I call people, and so that's what he was referring to. After this was like in the context of protracted negotiations between the Players Association and the league. And he was calling Demaryius Smith a liar. He wasn't making a race-based comment. By the way, on the whole race issue, it is worth noting that you don't become a Super Bowl winning coach and you don't last in the league as long as John Gruden did if you're a racist. That seems unlikely. That seems like a very questionable charge. John Gruden, with the number of black players in the NFL, the number of black players that he coached at with the Raiders, with the Bucks. In Washington, that, boy, it didn't come out until now, an email from 10 years ago that John Gruden was this racist. That seems implausible to me. Now, you want to get into using the F word to describe a gay person, you know, pejorative like that. And is that appropriate? No. Okay. But is this punishment being driven from the league, which is really the punishment, is that commensurate with the offense?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line.
Michael on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Oh, morning, Dan. Morning, Amy.
Morning.
I'm two very quick comments. I'm a little weirded out by the idea that private emails from 10 years ago can get someone fired from the an NFL coaching gig. Mm-hmm. And number two, if the NFL is going to be that sensitive, shouldn't Dr. Dre, who admitted domestic violence, be kicked out of the Super Bowl halftime show?
Oh, Michael, you don't know where we are in the culture. Thanks for the call. Good reference. Here, let me cede my time to Dave Chappelle to let you know where we are in the culture.
A lot of the LGBTQ community doesn't know the baby's history. He's a wild guy. He once shot a and killed him in Walmart. Oh, this is true. Google it. The baby shot and killed a in Walmart in North Carolina. Nothing bad happened to his career.
People laugh.
Do you see where I'm going with this? In our country, you can shoot and kill a but you better not hurt a gay person's feelings.
Yeah, see, that's where we're at. Mm-hmm. DaBaby, this rapper that made intemperate comments also about gay people, particularly gay men at a concert, and, you know, then the full music industry, Hollywood, celebutant culture came down on him. It turns out that he was involved. He was charged, and then the charges were dropped in killing a young black man in a Walmart. Some sort of altercation arose. So he's not convicted of anything, but that did happen. And nobody, you know, you heard the Chappelle audience. What? Like, nobody's even heard of it. Right. Much less has anybody commented on it. Much less did it impede his career in any way. But the intemperate comments about gay men at a concert then, you know, he needs to go to one of the re-education camps. And I'm not defending the ignorant things he said, just like I'm not defending the use of the F word to describe a gay man or a gay person. But again, the response is proportional or is not proportional. The outrage is selective or not selective when it comes to sort of name calling or being a purveyor of ignorance about other people as a group. Yeah, that's where the standards are a little blurry for me. Mary Ellen in Crete.
Well, hi, Dan and Amy. I read that article, and that comment that he made in the email to Demoris about Demoris Smith was during a lockout that was going to potentially create a problem for the coming NFL season. So he was very, very frustrated. Now, something that happened 11 years ago or 10 years ago, I'm amazed. And then when I read further in the article saying that they're reviewing 650,000 emails, somebody else is going to drop. Because don't tell me that there hasn't been exchanges that are now going to come out and everybody's going to be on them.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, look, the Wall Street Journal and other outlets reporting on, he shared pictures of topless women. Okay, well, I'll tell you what you're going to have to lock up every 13-year-old boy in America.
Yeah, I mean, and these pictures weren't secretly taken. They were out there for the public to view, and he shared some pictures. That does not offend me at all. And I'm not offended, too, that he didn't want female referees. That's his opinion. That's not – I get that.
Will the Sports Illustrated swimsuit calendar be dumped officially, or is it just going to have men in swimsuits now?
Eventually it will, yeah. Well, it already – I mean, it has transgenders.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Mike in Plano.
Hey, guys, just a couple quick points. First, what Gruden said, those emails, what pretty much every NFL fan thinks and has thought for the last few years. Anybody who's followed this league knows that they're trying to emasculate the sport with their endless push of racism, homosexuality, and extreme feminism. And Goodell and all his corporate buddies are behind it. And the second thing is Gruden is a target based on his beliefs. I mean, he is a white guy, and white Christian and or conservative coaches and players have become targets. We saw this, the guy that pitched for the White Sox the other night, Michael Kopech. They dug up tweets from high school of him homophobic slurs, and he had to apologize for it a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. Drew Brees got emasculated by his own teammates and had to apologize and sold out his own faith beliefs just so he could play football for one more year. And all he did was play one uneventful season where he had his ribs broken and his lungs punctured. And now he's working for corporate America, doing football commentary on NBC and doing gambling commercials. So there's your new and improved Drew Brees for you.
Thanks for the call, Mike. And so here's how this works. Robert Kaplan, who is a geopolitical scholar at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, had a good piece in the Journal last week about the tyranny of the crowd. And this is different and perhaps more dangerous, could breed a even more virulent variant of totalitarianism than we saw in the 20th century, bottom up rather than top down. And cites a scholar who wrote a famous book on the topic, Elias Canetti. The book was Crowds and Power. I mean, a lot of people always talk about reading Mass Delusions, the book by McKay from 180 years ago. Yeah, you should read that. You should also read Canetti, Crowds and Power. Canetti writes, the crowd emerges from the need of the lonely individual to conform with others because he can't exert dominance on his own. He exerts it through a crowd that speaks with one voice. The crowd's urge is always to grow, consuming all hierarchies, even as it feels persecuted and demands retribution. The crowd sees itself as entirely pure, having attained the highest virtue. Thus, one aim of the crowd is to hunt down the insufficiently virtuous. The tyranny of the crowd has many aspects, but Canetti says its most blatant form is that of the questioner and the accuser. When used as an intrusion of power, the accusing crowd is like a knife cutting into the flesh of the victim. The questioner knows what there is to find, but he wants actually to touch it and bring it to light. It's vivid and appropriately so. That's what you see here. The accuser and the questioner and the accuser.
Well, there are black players supporting Gruden this morning. Josh Jacobs. Why can't I find this? He's the black running back. Josh Jacobs, excuse me, yes. And he said, you know, it was 10 years ago. I trust him. I've been with him for 3 years now. People grow.
Oh, right. Again, the idea that the lonely individual who forms part of this mob to, you know, run around as modern day Torquemadas, the idea that they have absolute purity, that never an intemperate word crossed their lips, never a name was called. I mean, that's all they do is engage in name calling, actually, of their ideological opponents or those who won't submit, even if it's not for ideological reasons. That's what's happening. And so Gruden is just another example of that. Margot Burridge.
Yeah, this has just gotten way too far along. We have replaced true virtue with virtue signaling. And the last time I checked, only rape and murder went back more than 7 years. Even the IRS can't go after you for things that happened more than 7 years ago. But these people are going back for tiny infractions, for tiny slights that happened decades ago in some cases. And I think we had better find our forgiveness and find our kindness in our society, because viciousness is what is being lauded and treasured by these terrible people in the crowd that you described.
Thanks for the call, Margo. And, you know, to the point of, well, you know, Amy referenced one running back that's backing Gruden, Ron Jacobs on the Raiders right now. Why aren't more players? Why don't you hear veterans who are out of the league who played for his Tampa Bay Super Bowl winning team in 2002? Why don't you hear them coming to his defense? His fellow colleagues at ESPN when he was a color analyst and broadcaster. Well, I just told you why.
Mm-hmm.
Because the crowd will come for them next.
Yep.
And they know it.
They're Dan foaming at the mouth, man. They're ready
Dan,
to go.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The Pentagon's former software chief and its first software chief quit his job, saying yesterday, China has already won the tech war, guaranteeing global dominance. Quoting him, "We have no competing fighting chance against China in 15 to 20 years. Right now, it's already a done deal. It's already over, in my opinion," said Nicholas Chalin, former now Pentagon software chief. He believes that China will dominate the future by controlling everything from media narratives to geopolitics. The U.S., like Beijing, should have prioritized AI, machine learning, cyber capabilities, but we haven't. And while China is forcing compliance with tech companies, state, you know, working with, quote unquote, meaning forcing those tech companies to heel at the feet of the Politburo there in Beijing, we have not done so well with our tech companies working collaboratively in furtherance of America's cybersecurity. So it's all over. Was fun while it lasted. Get ready for a dominant China. I'm not quite sure I take those comments at face value, and I'm not quite so sure that it's as inexorable as the former software chief at the Pentagon says. There's a lot of opinions, including those of Gordon Chang and other scholars, Chinese scholars and scholars of in the geopolitical space, that I don't think have such a cynical view of the possibilities of America's continued dominance as the world's superpower. But for more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Seth Jones. He's the Senior Vice President and Director of the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's got a new book out, which is in part right on topic, Three Dangerous Men, Russia, China, Iran, and the Rise of Irregular Warfare. Seth, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
What's your reaction to the comments by that that guy who just resigned from the Pentagon?
I just don't think that's true at all. In fact, I think I think China certainly is a threat. But if you look at what the Chinese are doing, they're focused on a massive espionage campaign against American companies because of the advantages that those companies have right now on everything from artificial intelligence to nanotechnology to machine learning. But I do think, you know, the U.S. has to recognize that this is a serious area where the Chinese are competing and attempting to compete. At the end of the day, I think the U.S. needs to leverage its advantages, and they are in an open economic system. So our companies remain
yes.
extremely advantageous. So I think that's defeatist language, frankly.
You know, so do I. And it just struck me as hearkening back to the defeatist language of the central planners of the Reagan era, who thought that Soviet Union's dominance of the world was similarly inexorable. You know, it sounds like this this Biden administration appointee, effectively, is upset there's not enough central planning going on. He's upset that the government isn't imposing its will on Google and other tech companies to force those companies to accede to whatever the priorities of the federal government is, rather than their responsibilities to their shareholders and employees, for example. And people who take that perspective, you know, always miss the internal contradictions of totalitarian societies and systems like communist China, just as they miss the internal contradictions of the Soviets.
Well, I think there's no question about that. And again, I would just point to, you know, the MSF, Chinese intelligence, as well as the intelligence components, including the offensive cyber components of the People's Liberation Army, the military of the Communist Party of China. There is a massive espionage campaign against American companies, I mean, in addition to the government. To steal the very technology, and again, you don't steal that kind of technology from innovative U.S. companies if you're winning. You steal it because you're losing, and you need it, and you need it to be advantageous. And what Americans need to understand is the relationship, frankly, between the U.S. government and companies can be conflictual, and it should be in some ways. In China, it is much closer. The MSF and the PLA steal information from U.S. and other Western companies and give it to Chinese state-run companies to be more competitive. So there's a much closer relationship this is part of the impetus for the espionage. But again, the point here is that you don't do this kind of stuff if you're winning in large degree. You do it because you're behind.
When you talk about irregular warfare with respect to these three enemies of America, Russia, China, Iran, you're obviously describing one aspect of irregular warfare, the cyber warfare, the piracy of intellectual property and so forth. What else would, like, the Confucius Institutes that the CHICOM set up at American universities be another example of this irregular warfare? Give us some other examples of things that are ongoing that policymakers should be paying attention to.
The Chinese, Confucius Institutes are definitely part of this broader irregular aspect of warfare. The important part is the a huge part of the Chinese competition right now is below the threshold of conventional and certainly nuclear war. At this point, they are not trying to get an advantage by sending conventional forces onto a battlefield. So it's the Thousand Talents program. This is the program that paid large sums of money to, say, the chair of the nanotechnology department at Harvard, Robert Lieber, to bring in that kind of expertise. It's the taking of islands in the South China Sea through dredging up sand and building signals intelligence, electronic warfare, missile platforms on those islands. Again, not by force, but through dredgers and fishing vessels overnight. It's the entire Belt and Road Initiative, which is using massive amounts of Chinese money, capital, to build roadways and ports in cities across Africa, Asia, and even Europe, and then to take that economic leverage and to push for political decisions on Taiwan, on Hong Kong, that are to China's advantage. So it's using economic, frankly, money to gain the political leverage. These are all aspects of competition well below the threshold of conventional war. It's the 5G market, Huawei. Taking large amounts of data off of platforms and then bringing it back to Chinese intelligence. These are all aspects of what we call irregular warfare. And frankly, out of all the countries in the world, China is the country that gave the world Sun Tzu, the art of war, and Mao on guerrilla warfare. I mean, this country has been working on these irregular activities for centuries.
Well, then why did we let this happen? I mean, that Pentagon's former software chief said the U.S. government systems mirror kindergarten level in comparison to China and other countries. But why would we allow that to happen?
Well, I think part of the problem, frankly, is we're stuck in a bit of a Cold War mindset where, the O plans, the operational plans, these are the scenarios when I was in the Pentagon for fighting other countries, Russia, China, even Iran, the O plans and the war games that I have participated in, both classified and unclassified, often look like the Battle of Midway, or during the Cold War, it was the Fulda Gap, the inter-German border, where we expected the Soviets to send in tanks. And this is not the way the Chinese are fighting. So, like, we haven't fully embraced how the Chinese are conceptualizing warfare. We're thinking tanks. We're building huge aircraft carriers and F-35 fifth-generation aircraft. This is predominantly not the realm that they're in. They're in these irregular activities. So I think we've got to get down to that level.
The book, Three Dangerous Men, Russia, China, Iran, you're talking about three dangerous men, but you're not talking about Putin, Xi, or Khamenei. You're talking about essentially their implementation guys.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you know, there's all of those countries, Russia, China, and Iran, have leaders that are involved in all aspects of politics and military campaigns in their countries. What I wanted to focus on is the key individuals that are orchestrating these irregular campaigns. And on the Russian side, there's no question that Valery Gerasimov, who's chief of the army staff, he's the one that orchestrated the seizing of Crimea, the war in eastern Ukraine, the taking of Syria, and a lot of the GRU, the Russian intelligence operations, cyber operations directed at the U.S. He's extraordinarily influential. On the Iranian side, it's Qasem Soleimani, who the Trump administration targeted and killed in January of 2020, the head of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard's Quds Force. That's the primary regular force within Iran. And then with the Chinese, Zheng Yuzhou, the vice chairman of the CMC, China's main military commission. These are the leading thinkers on these kinds of activities. And that's really what I wanted to show.
And you know, using Soleimani as an example, since he was taken out, as you mentioned, by a Trump-authorized drone strike, So he's just backfilled. I mean, this is part of the culture now, the irregular warfare in Iran, China, and Russia. So you lose basically your kingpin in Soleimani, but he's just backfilled by others who are going to pursue the same strategy, I presume.
That's absolutely correct. The Soleimani was backfilled by Ismail Hani, who had been the deputy of the IRGC Quds Force for several decades. So he's continued those Iranian policies in Lebanon, supporting Hezbollah across Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan now, and then other countries, including Yemen. So, I mean, this is the thing. It's the long-term policies of these countries will definitely go beyond the lives and the positions of these individuals, but they're instrumental in forming it, at least today.
And you argue that the Biden administration's withdrawal and perhaps the quality of it, the competency of it, reinforces this vulnerability that we have to the irregular warfare campaigns that our enemies are waging. How so?
Well, the challenge that we face in Afghanistan, and I served there in U.S. Special Operations, so I've spent probably far too much time in the country. The challenge has been that in that vacuum, we've seen a big increase in Iranian Quds Force. It's that paramilitary arm that Soleimani ran. The Russian GRU that Gerasimov oversees, it's the organization that, as we found out during the Trump administration, had provided money to the Taliban to conduct attacks against U.S. and other foreign soldiers. And the Chinese have moved in. So all of those countries have expanded their activities in Afghanistan. And we had CIA there. We'd had special operations forces. We'd had fixed-wing aircraft right on the Chinese border. So I did see advantages to having such military, intelligence, and diplomatic personnel right on the Chinese border in case there was an increase in tension. And I think a withdrawal, you know, makes it a little more difficult.
He is Seth Jones, Senior VP and Director of the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. The book, Three Dangerous Men, Russia, China, Iran, and the Rise of Irregular Warfare. Seth, thanks for joining us, and good luck with the book. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Mayor Pete, haven't spoken about him in a while. He was a former mayor of South Bend who was elevated to transportation secretary because of his love of trains.
Right.
The romance he finds at airports.
He proposed at O'Hare. Come on.
Mayor Pete, are you just pointing to modes of transportation and saying you love them? Yes, I am. I love planes. So the mannequin from the men's department at the Macy's in Mishawaka, who's now the transportation secretary, went on with about the intellect that he can handle. That would be Mika on Morning Joe. To discuss the supply chain disruptions and what what Mayor I can barely get it out. What Mayor Pete is going to do about those supply chain disruptions to get the Western world firing on all cylinders again. Take a listen.
This is a major challenge, and this is something that's been a major priority for the White House, certainly for our department. It's why the White House set up this task force. And what we're looking at is basically everything between those ships and your shelves that gets the goods to where they need to be. Part of that's things like physical infrastructure. Part of that is, as you say, is labor. And look, obviously, it's an incredibly complicated situation. We're talking about global supply chains, and it's mostly private sector systems. But we have a big role to play, and that's why we've been convening all of the different players. For example, held roundtables, bringing together everybody who's connected to the ports, the port operators, the port owners, labor unions, shipping. And remember, a lot of this isn't, when you look at these backups, for example, on the ships, it isn't just about the ships, right? If they're in this photo, that means the ship is there. The question is, what's in the way of the container getting off the ship and out to where it needs to be?
Wow. Deep thinking about global supply chains from
so
Mayor Pete.
Dreamy.
Go back to the men's
hero.
Department.
Yes.
Go back to that Macy's men's department, young man. For more on the topic, please be joined by Don Boudreau, American economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Don, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Dan and Amy.
Task force and roundtables. Finally, I think we've got this supply chain problem licked.
If you have a problem, call in the Politburo or the American version of it, which sounds like that's what they're doing. That's what government people do, right? They convene all the parties. He was right to say it's incredibly complicated. It's far more complicated than any meeting of representatives of labor and ports and government can solve. The governments around the world, including in the United States, have disrupted labor supply. Both by preventing people from working and by paying people not to work. That's a major reason for the supply. I like to call them supply webs, not supply chains. The supply web obstructions, and so the government creates this problem. It's a government created problem. There's no question that it's a government created problem. And now the government's riding to the rescue, pretending it's going to solve the problem. It's just sickening, actually.
Right, you got what did I see in Savannah? The port in Savannah, Georgia, 80,000 shipping containers stuck there. There was the backup in Long Beach the other week. Now, we have seen at least last week it was reported the price of these shipping containers had dropped significantly. I mean, still artificially high, but had dropped significantly, and that seemed to be an indicator that maybe some of the blockages were being relieved, but maybe not.
Yeah, it's my understanding. I don't know fully exactly what the Department of Transportation is jurisdiction over, but you know, it's about highways and it's about federal funding for railroads. These problems are not caused by a lack of highway space. They're not caused by inadequate port facilities, although that may be a longer run problem. These problems are caused by the supply web disruptions that I just mentioned. We don't have enough workers. We don't have both to unload these things. I saw a piece in the Wall Street Journal just last week. Some of these cargo ships are just being abandoned. It's amazing by their owners, and the crews are kind of just left on the ships because the owners are just leaving them out to sea or close to port. Because there's nothing to do with them,
it's
more of a labor problem than a transportation problem.
Right, maybe that's something that some knowledge that could be imparted on the Biden administration with respect to their policies. Because I don't know, I just sort of start from the premise that if these global multinational corporations that ship products from all over the world, the Walmarts of the world. If they've got supply chain issues, then it's probably something that is too sophisticated for central planners to come in and fix for them.
Yeah, absolutely. The people who have the most amount of expertise on these matters are the people who design and daily monitor and tweak these things. The people, the logistics experts at places like Target and other shipping companies, not political appointees led by the Biden administration or appointed by the Biden administration. You're absolutely correct.
And also unhelpful, we saw oil yesterday hit a 7-year high, artificially so again because of Biden policy. And so you're making the cost of energy higher than you're making the cost of doing business higher. And that's not good for the bottom line or for economic growth.
No, when you restrict supplies of anything, including, of course, fuel, you reduce the amount of things that finally get to consumers. And when you do that, you raise the cost of living. You raise the prices of things that ordinary American families can buy on their budgets. You're right, Dan. That will be a consequence of these misguided policies.
Let's talk about that wealth killer that is inflation. You know, I was having this conversation with a friend yesterday. He's like, you know, everywhere I go, I see, you know, prices that are 20 to 40% higher than they were a few months ago. And yet the stated inflation rate is 5.3%. And so you know, what gives? And my only answer was, well, here's how they calculate inflation, the mystics in the federal government. You know, they take a basket of goods and they do a survey of Americans on a monthly basis, and they come up with sort of this aggregate, you know, inflation number across mm-hmm. the basket of goods among ostensibly a representative survey of Americans. So that's the formula they use. I can't tell you whether or not the actual calculation is accurate. I can just tell you what the formula is. What's your perspective on whether the number we're getting is the real number or something that is being sort of understated yeah. for political purposes?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. This 5 point, would you say 5.7%?
5.3, yeah.
This is high. I mean,
no, I know. Yes.
Even if that were completely accurate, we're still looking at significant inflation. We're looking at the kind of inflation that had people that you know, in the 1970s quite upset. It eventually got even higher than that in the 70s. But this is high in itself. But I agree with you completely. I think that number vastly understates the rate of inflation. There are various things that inflation monitors, let's call them, can't detect. One of the things that I see just as an ordinary citizen, and I'm sure other people do too, is the reduction in the quality of service, the reduction in the amount, in the selection of things. Waiting times at restaurants, for example, are much higher. Waiting times in some of the supermarkets I go to are higher. The quality of a lot of the goods that I get is lower. Pete's Coffee, for example, here in Fairfax, Virginia, where I live, they no longer serve any of their breakfast foods so that you can eat them indoors. So they don't have, you know, breakfast plates and proper utensils. They only serve it to go. It's a small thing, but those kinds of things add up. And so one of the ways that businesses respond to higher costs, well, one way, of course, is raising their price, which is easily detected by an inflation monitor. Another way is to reduce the quality of what they produce. And that's a form of hidden inflation. It does not show up in the official inflation statistics, but it's real because ultimately inflation means money, a given amount of money buys a lesser amount of output. And whether that amount of lesser output comes in the form of lower quality, that is I think evidence of hidden inflation. And I believe it's quite significant, but it's very difficult to measure. And so it doesn't get headlines. And to get to your point, it is politically convenient to hide this fact because we've been told now for quite some time that all this extra spending, all this increase in the supply of money by the Fed, oh, no, don't worry. The government has it under control. It's not going to lead to inflation. Our masters they know what they're doing. Well, they don't know what they're doing.
Well,
you cannot inject this amount of money into the economy without having these kinds of inflationary results.
For us consumers who have to go, you know, the grocery store two or three times a week, how long is this high inflation number is going to last? Any idea? And what will it take to get people back to work so that you don't have to wait those long lines because no one's showing up for work?
Well, that's right. And part of this is not a new point. Of course, part of that is because you have a lot of schools that are shut down or that are hybrid, so parents, or even under the threat of being shut down, so a lot of parents, even if they aren't being paid not to work, they're reluctant to go back to school because who's going to watch their kids? There's all this cash that a lot of these people now have that they feel they can wait a longer time before they accept employment and return to the job. So who knows how long it's going to last, Amy, but it's very difficult to predict these things in detail. But my gut feeling is that so much purchasing power, excess purchasing power, has been injected into the economy over the past 18 or 19 months that I think even the officially reported inflation rate is going to get much higher. I don't dare put a number on it, but much higher than the current report, and that the unofficial amount of inflation will be even higher than that. We're going to continue to get the supply disruptions, continue to get lower quality products, continue to experience longer waits. in line at various stores and restaurants. And I think it's going to last for a while.
And now layer in this new global minimum corporate tax rate of 15% that the Biden administration is attempting to orchestrate. And they've gotten some consensus on the topic, even from Ireland, which rate is 12.5%. Now, the footnote there is Ireland wants the 15% to be a cap, not a floor. But nonetheless, 15% global minimum corporate tax. Your reaction to what the impact of that would be were it to actually be abided by all of those countries that are signaling affirmation at present?
Two words: very bad. I mean, it's a tax on the major organization that produces goods and services for people to consume. It's a tax on the major source of high productivity employment. And the more when you tax something more, you get less of it. So you're going to get less output, you're going to get less employment growth from corporations. It's going to divert resources from more efficient uses into less efficient uses. It's not good. And it's so hypocritical. It's a cartel. You know, the government now is concerned about monopoly where they shouldn't be concerned. Oh, we're about all these private monopolies. The market can take care of private monopolies. When they arise, entrepreneurs come in and compete the monopolies away. But when governments conspire against the general public, the media applauds it. Oh, look what they're doing. They're preventing corporations and rich people from escaping taxation. It's cartelizing against tax competition. I think tax competition is a good thing.
Yeah, and it's tough to keep cartels together, OPEC notwithstanding. So we'll see how that goes, how those promises are abided or not. He's Don Boudreau, American economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Don, thanks as always.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, in the America we grew up in, the question was, what color is your parachute? Remember that part?
Right.
Yeah. Richard Bowles, Episcopal minister, I think.
Oh, yes.
We love Episcopal. In 2021 America, what color is your COVID bracelet?
Yeah, because as vaccinated staffers returned, you know, to that station down the dial there, 890. Remember, they used to be conservative. Remember, they used to have Rush Limbaugh. They're offering color-coded bracelets.
I remember they used to have Dan Proft. I remember they used to have Amy Jacobson.
Oh, yeah, back in the day, yeah. Well, they're offering color-coded bracelets to indicate their willingness to engage with colleagues. So here's the deal. According to a memo from Cumulus Media, red means please stay 6 feet away. Yellow means some contact is acceptable. And green means comfortable with appropriate office greetings. So I want like a gold spangled one to say, like, I'm all in. Let's hug it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it came from the program director there. She said, please respect everyone's levels of comfort as we transition back into the office space.
For easy P-hat listening, go to AM890 WLS.
Can you? Are we in grade school? This is moronic.
It's pathetic. The snowflakes. Ugh. I mean, I'm not going to comment on those that have to live under those rules. I'm just commenting on those that are imposing them. Cumulus, by the way. So I have some experience dealing with Cumulus, as do you. Is just a terrible operator. Terrible operator. I mean, I did not enjoy my interactions with them or the flunkies they put in after the guys I came in with as program director, like Drew Hayes. The flunkies they put in after that generation are a joke.
Well, and it's
they're woke, right. P-hat, corporate shills for a station and for a media company that does not like conservative talk radio. And you may have noticed you're not getting it at WLS anymore because they don't like it.
Exactly.
And if you don't think this is reflective of the corporate culture, I mean, this is the sort of thing you might see at like WCPT.
WCPT isn't even doing this.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
That's how progressive this bull jive is.
That's
what
I'm saying.
But it's not just WLS, I have to tell you. WGN, WLS-TV.
Oh, of course.
No, they don't let reporters into the station. Reporters have to drive their own cars. They can't drive with a photographer. No.
Whatever.
They can't get back into the newsroom.
Oh, my God.
Well, it's stupid.
The trials and the tribulations.
No, I'm just saying that it's not just WLS. They're all COVIDians.
Yeah, but
they're all scared they're going to die from COVID.
We understand. Ridiculous. We understand that the network, your friends and the network affiliates and the other stations are all left. WLS purports not to be. They're lying.
Coming up on...
That's what you should understand from this. And by the way, Cumulus also one of the first to impose a vax mandate, you know, per their bracelet protocol. They recently, essentially fired a morning person in Detroit.
Yeah, we're going to have her on later this week.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Mike Manapkin runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out.
Dan and Amy, that theme music means it's time for our weekly conversation with Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, WirePoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Let's start with Chicago crime stories. I got one.
Okay, I got one too.
Gary Coleman, what's he talking about, Willis? was in court after he punched a 60-year-old woman in the face in the Loop, causing her to strike her head on the sidewalk and lose consciousness. Maybe he thought she was the Gooch. He couldn't identify himself in a court appearance. The judge sentenced Coleman to 8 months conditional discharge for knocking the woman out. Then Gary Coleman walked on the streets of Chicago with the same chronic mental health challenges he walked into court with. The next evening at the Cermak Green Line station, 66-year-old tourist and her daughter, who had just packed up her race pack for Sunday's Chicago Marathon. The younger woman saw Coleman walking toward her mother, and he was talking to himself angrily, she later told police. She turned away. When she turned back, she saw her mother in midair, falling to the train tracks below after Coleman punched her in the face. An ambulance took the 66-year-old woman to Northwestern Memorial with a broken right orbital bone, a dislocated wrist, a concussion, and cuts to her forehead.
And it's a different Gary Coleman. The actor Gary Coleman died in 2010. But yeah, they have the same.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. Right. Yeah. What you talking about, Amy? Yeah, I got it.
It's disgusting. And the whole world was here because of the Chicago Marathon this weekend.
This is the best line. A judge, Cook County Judge, ordered Coleman held without bail on the new allegations. His public defender said Coleman lives with his daughter, has a 14-year-old child, was recently admitted to a university.
What?
Really?
Okay, what university is that?
I want to hear more about that. I assume he
got into
the Bill Ayers scholar at UIC to study criminology. if real people like two elderly women weren't being brutalized, this would be a joke, but it's no joke.
Well, in Wicker Park, while everybody was here from around the world to run the marathon, there was a mass shooting, because that's a new thing now, to just start, you know, rolling shootings. This happened at the 1500 block of North Milwaukee. In crowded streets of partygoers. And that's your round one, then your round two. They didn't stop. Did not stop. And all a 32-year-old man shot dead, four others injured, and, you know, pub owners, this pub owner from Kevin O'Donnell from Pint Irish Pub is, you know, it used to be a nice neighborhood, right?
It's normally a great nightlife for everybody, but it's really turned into a mess. There's kids, there's families that live right here. I mean, this is just, I mean, it's horrific.
I mean, hearing that, it sounds like a war zone.
Wicker Park, Lakeview, Westtown, Austin,
all one now. Bucktown, I mean, it's awful.
And for more on this, now we bring in our friend Ted Dabrowski, president at WirePoints.com. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Dan. Thanks, Amy. And that was pretty depressing, wasn't it?
Well, it's
our reality now.
Yeah, it is depressing. It's depressing that you have public officials that are not interested in keeping people safe by removing repeat violent offenders from the streets. That's the depressing thing, and a public that doesn't seem to want to hold anybody accountable for it.
Well, that's precisely right. And, you know, I want to point out the readers to I think, a really good piece today. It came out yesterday in the Chicago Tribune. That, you know, it's rare to see any kind of reporting or data that kind of hits at what's really going on. And Jens Ludwig from University of Chicago came out with a piece, and you know he basically takes on that narrative. Oh, it's bad everywhere. All major cities are seeing crime. You know, and it's true that all major cities are seeing crime increases or homicide increases. But what he shows, it's really true about what an outlier Chicago has become, and it shows a big spike in you know, per capita homicides compared to New York and L.A. It's you know, we have three times the homicide rate that L.A. does. We have six times the homicide rate that New York does. And so, you know, I want to point out that I'm glad he pointed that out. I don't know if I agree with everything Jens Ludwig says about the solutions, but kudos to him for pointing out that hey, you know, forget these narratives that things aren't as, you know, or things are just as bad everywhere, because it's just not true. We're an extreme outlier.
Well, what are some of the solutions that he recommended?
Well, he doesn't, you know, I think in this case he doesn't. What he does say, and I think it's pretty good, he says, look, you know, it's not just education, because New York and other big cities have just as bad educational problems as we do, although I would argue we're probably worse. He says, look, the gun laws have been very strict here, and that's not helping. He pointed out a couple other facts and said none of them are working. What he did show is that, you know, L.A., and you know, I'm not a big federal consent supporter, but he showed that the consent decree in L.A. dropped the L.A. Homicide rates significantly. The question is, and I think back to Dan's point, nobody's accountable anymore. Nobody's accountable for anything. You know, I was looking at the education results in Illinois and in many cities, Decatur, for example. The results are so bad, and nobody cares. And that's, I think, the problem. It's the same thing here in crime. And so we're going to have to look at it differently. But I do like that somebody's going to point out the facts and that they, you know, they fly in the face of what many others are saying.
This story out of a nursing facility in Danville. Leaders and staff at a federal veterans nursing home in Illinois mismanaged a coronavirus outbreak that killed 11 residents in fall 2020. Well after employees had been put on notice about the danger the pandemic posed to its elderly population, a staff member exposed at the home was denied a test and told just to wear a mask while finishing a shift caring for residents. The employee tested positive the next day. Testing was then inconsistent even after the virus spread at this Veterans Affairs Complex in Danville. According to the IG report from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, direct staff described chaos and a lack of awareness of what to do. And here we go again, the competence of the state government when it comes to their, well, providing for the safety of residents in their care, whether it's Legionnaires' disease outbreak or in the era of COVID, the management of COVID in these facilities where you have people who serve this country honorably are promised care in their golden years, and instead they get this, you know, rank incompetence that goes from the Ronner administration to the Jelly Belly administration. The culture, nothing changes. You can change the personnel, you don't change the culture.
Yeah, you know, all these things are systemic, and you know, like talking about the violence, you know, this wave we have in Chicago is 30 years going in terms of divergence from L.A. and New York. Yes, the same thing in COVID, and I will say this, you know, when we make our long list of all the mistakes we made on COVID, number right up there at the top will be how we just failed to take care of old people's homes, whether they're veterans or not. And it's you know, 50% of deaths in some places in some of those northeastern states is 60-70% of COVID deaths were in retirement homes. And, you know, we knew that before COVID landed in the U.S., that it destroyed elderly people. We knew that when it first hit the facility in Washington State. That was the first place they got hit. And yet in Illinois, where we had plenty of time, we couldn't figure out how to stop that. And, you know, in particular veterans homes, which, you know, there's not that many of them, right?
Well, and we have, you know, Phil Murphy, the governor of New Jersey, he's up for re-election in November, and that's a close race, not as close as the Virginia race, but close race in a pretty blue state. And New Jersey has been the worst on this score, even worse than New York. And one wonders if there'll be any accountability for any of these COVIDian lockdowners who failed, who simultaneously failed where the lockdown, if you will, was most appropriate with respect to the elderly. I just, and so Pritzker's there too, and there's been very, very skimpy reporting on exactly what did and didn't happen in these nursing homes. You have to wait for Veterans Affairs to give you an IG report because you have the General Assembly too focused on things like, I don't know, figuring out which statues of themselves to erect and trying to repeal parental notification for abortions in this state.
Well, you know, I think the problem kind of comes down to what we said all along is that, you know, Pritzker and others never focused on where the real problems were. I think they were obsessed with getting power over the whole system, over everybody, when it was a clear indicator that should have been number one focus, and they missed that. And, you know, there are a lot of people pointing this out at the very beginning, all these, you know, what was happening in New York and New Jersey, and we still never saw that focus. I know Amy was focused on it early on in the press conferences, but, yeah, we lost that battle to get focus where it belonged, and instead we focused on schools and other places where, you know, frankly, that's not where the problem was and is.
Low-risk kids and low-risk settings. Speaking of that, when do you think our politicians are going to come out and set us free from masks? Because back in May 13th, the positivity rate was 2.84%. That's when they dropped the indoor mask mandate. And right now we're below that, and we're just waiting. And nobody's, you know, there hasn't been a lot of press conferences, but what's the end game? What's the exit plan?
Well, you know, I think the pressure is going to start building a little bit because if these rates stay low like they are, we're starting to see reports. You know, Reuters just came out on a UK study. The American Pediatrics are saying, you know, everybody's saying now that the Delta is no more dangerous for kids when it comes to serious illness and death. And, you know, the numbers in Illinois themselves, we reported on it last week. We're going to send out a blast, I think, today. The numbers just don't warrant. Basically, we need to get back to local control, right? They don't warrant a mandate. And, you know, you look at the hospitalizations, they never got anywhere near the peak for kids. And the deaths have been pretty constant, very low, 0 to 3 deaths a month. And sad as and tragic as they are, they haven't worsened during Delta.
Look at our case positivity rate right now, 2.1%, yet we're still wearing masks indoors.
Still wearing masks is one thing. The vaccine mandates that may be coming for kids as young as 5, per what Gavin Newsom is prepared to do, not apparently for his own kids quite yet, but for all 5 years old and up in California schools, why wouldn't that be implemented in Illinois schools, too? I mean, they're coming from the same place. And this against the backdrop of Nordic countries suspending Moderna usage for children of that age group.
Well, it's still shocking to me, and I think shocking to a lot of people that we're going to, you know, use a vaccine on kids that are 99 point, you know, the numbers go pretty far, 99.99, you know, keep going, survival rates, and yet, you know, we don't have long-term studies. We know that, you know, kids are largely safe, even, you know, hospitalizations have been short. Why we're going to use them or have them have to take that on a mandate basis? You know, you're talking about a lot of decisions and families, and it's a very complex issue. And to save, you know, we've got almost 98% of all Illinoisans now have at least one jab if you're 65 and older. So, you know, things are moving in the right direction when it comes to protecting people. But you know, the obsession with power, I think, is still there.
Right, and you don't need studies when you have New York Times chief COVID reporters just pumping out misinformation. Apoorva Mandavilli reporting, and this had to be corrected, but of course, who reads the correction? 900,000 U.S. kids hospitalized since the beginning of the pandemic. The actual number? 63,000 approximately hospitalized since August of 2020 when stats first became available. So, you know, off by nearly a factor of, 18 or so. This is the same thing we have in Chicago, where the so-called informers are actually the misinformers.
Well, you know, Dan, I just heard, sorry to pick on you, but I just heard on your radio an ad that said cases for kids have tripled since the summer. And that's true because cases for kids in the summer, like in June or whenever that was, were really, really, really low. So a tripling, you know, tripling might not mean anything, but the way it's messaged, right, is to scare and provide to create fear. So tripling, you know, get your kids vaccinated, and you know, it's just not a fair messaging. But that's the game they're playing.
Yeah, why don't you update us when the number of kids who've died with COVID in the country exceeds the number of kids who've been shot in Chicago just this year? That they come back to me when we're there. How about that?
Well, let me just give you some numbers there, right? I mean, do I have them in my head? We've had 18 children in the year and a half of COVID under the age of 17 that have died from COVID.
In Illinois.
Correct, in Illinois. And yet, you know, you can take the homicide number now for kids under the age of 20. I don't have the precise numbers there in my head, but it's over 100. You know, accidents, right? You know, riding your bike and going to the lake, they're much, much higher. And we let our kids do that. So we have a perverse understanding of COVID and the risk for kids. Yeah. And it's sad because of the data that's put out.
Perverse understanding, full stop. We just have a perverse understanding, just generally, of just about everything in this state. Perverse understanding, good phrase.
Right. And parents should be more worried about their kids getting shot in Chicago than getting COVID. And I tell my neighbors, you could double mask your kid outside, that's fine, but she has a better chance of dying from homicide than she does from COVID. Because we've had 3 COVID deaths, 38 fatally shot, 283 and rising that have been shot that are 17 and younger.
Well, Amy, normally I disagree with you because a lot of kids aren't hanging out in the South Side and West Side where most of the...
Doesn't matter.
You know, yeah, but now when you're starting to have shootings in Wicker Park and others, and of course those are late morning stuff, but, you know, it's getting dangerous.
No, ours was in Lakeview. I'm sorry for interrupting. Ours at Lakeview High School, which they shot into a park, was at 10:43 at night.
There you go. Yeah. So it's getting dangerous for ordinary people. And that's, not everybody's ordinary, but, you know, you're talking about it's spreading, and that's not good, and that's not good for Chicago. And, you know, I think if I have any message, right, and you know, the powers that be don't care, but, you know, this is a time where it's going to start impacting much more than just lives, right? We're going to talk about the economy and Chicago's thriving downtown and all that. And once that starts to unravel, watch out.
He is Ted Dabrowski, president at wirepoints.com or .org. It takes you to the same place, Wirepoints, which is a repository for all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. This is Chicago's morning answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Does being a boy and a girl matter? Does being a man and a woman matter? Are those distinct characterizations? Is the relationship between boys or between men the same as between a man and a woman, a boy and a girl? Is the relationship between women, female friends, the same as a woman and a man or a boy and a girl? I ask that question because of the continued push to eliminate those distinctions. California mandating gender-neutral toy aisles for large retailers, the latest strike for androgyny by the androgynous governor of California, Gavin Newsom, being the first state to adopt a law that demands large retailers offer gender-neutral toy aisles. Retail stores with 500 or more workers must sell toys and childcare products, excluding clothes. Why? In a gender-neutral section that's labeled at the discretion of the retail, regardless of whether they have been traditionally marketed for either girls or boys. Companies that fail to comply with the new law could face a civil penalty of $250 for a first violation and $500 for any subsequent violations. The sponsor of the legislation saying, quote, we need to stop stigmatizing what's acceptable for certain genders and just let kids be kids. Is that what we're doing?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Is that what we're doing with the gender neutrality, eliminating distinctions artificially, pretending the dynamics are the same regardless of sex? We're just letting kids be kids?
No, we're forcing some parents are forcing their political views and beliefs down their kids' throats.
Is that what we're doing when we're celebrating and redefining comic book heroes as LGBTQ? The Man of Steel, the latest to be redefined.
Is he bisexual or full-on gay?
Superman now confirmed to be bisexual. That'll be great news for Kristen Sinema. According to the DC team behind the reintroduction of Superman as bi. It's a pretty big deal doing it with John Kent as Superman. John's the son of Clark, yeah. John, the son of Clark, is bi. I hope this kind of thing will not be seen as a big deal in the future. No, of course not. Mm-hmm. It will be interesting to see him not only try to find himself as a person, but a global superhero in the complex atmosphere of modern life. Say the creators of Bi Superman.
What about Lois?
Haven't read it.
She's playing second fiddle now, or what's her role? Mm-hmm. Is she going to become a lesbian?
The question for John, Clark Kent's son,
and
our creative team, they go on to say, is what should Superman, new Superman, fight for today? Can a 17-year-old Superman battle giant robots while ignoring the climate crisis? Of course not. Can someone with super sight and super hearing ignore injustices beyond his borders? Can he ignore the plight of asylum seekers? The desire to do good for Earth's everyday needs is a trait not from Clark Kent, but instead one from John's mother, Lois Lane. Right.
Oh, sorry, that's his mom.
It's interesting because it's all a bit confused, isn't it? Why are we recognizing any difference between Clark and Lois? Why are we elevating mom over dad? Why even have those distinctions in a world where it's parent one and parent two on birth certificates? Is there anything important about a man and a woman and the relationship between a man and a woman, the relationship as distinguished from women who are friends, as distinguished from men who are friends? And this, of course, goes to young men and women, kids. Related story, Danish toy giant Lego has announced it will endeavor to remove quote-unquote harmful gender stereotypes from its line because boys are reluctant to play with toys marketed towards girls.
Aren't Legos all black, white, yellow, red, purple? I mean, not purple. Primary colors.
Yeah.
Working hard to make Lego more inclusive, said Julia
Colvin. They commissioned a study, did Lego, carried out by the... I mean, I can't believe this is actually a thing, but it's
okay,
a thing.
Okay, what is it?
Carried out by the Gina Davis Institute on Gender and Media. The Gina Davis Institute for Gender and the Media? That's a thing? That's an organization? Gina Davis, like the actress? The Gina Davis Institute on Gender in the Media found 71% of boys prefer not to play with girls' toys as they would expect to be made fun of by other children or adults. Girls, on the other hand, were said to be fine with playing with either line of toys, of course, because girls are more involved. Mm-hmm. A study of 7,000 parents and children between the ages of 6 and 14 claimed boys were encouraged by their parents to take part in activities surrounding the STEM fields, while girls were said to be pushed towards traditionally feminine activities such as dressing up, dancing, and baking. This is the problem. Is that a problem? Is it a problem if mom and dad teach their daughter what it means to be a girl and a woman? Is it a problem if mom and dad teach their son what it means to be a boy and a man?
Andrew wanted and received an Easy Bake Oven when he was 5 years old. Yes, it was pink because it didn't come in any other color, but I'm like, men cook. It's okay.
And so your point is what?
No, my point is that, you know, as a parent, you can have them play with other gender toys. That doesn't mean that, you know, back then we're not pushing them to become a woman. We're just letting them, you know, explore. Mm-hmm. Now pushing this and then making everything gender, you know, gender free is just ridiculous. But it doesn't surprise me. Christmas is going to look a lot different this year for the kiddos.
Well, I guess it could. I guess that's up to the parents. Is there anything different, distinct? Is this important? I mean, in Genesis, we're taught that a man and a woman are made for one another. Is that not the case anymore? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Can you build a society on an anthropological and biological lie? And, of course, not just a society, but one that is unified. Because everybody's interested in unity. Sure, they are.
Right. No, they're interested in shoving their agenda down your throat. That's what they're interested in. Comply or die.
Anthony Esselin on the topic, the great Anthony Esselin. Good example, as I think I've said before, if a profile status in society was based on intellectual chops, Anthony Esselin would be a household name, and half the people you, more than half, almost all of the people you watch on Fox News or listen to on the radio would not be. But he's not, because that's not our society. He writes, with every proposal regarding men and women, boys and girls, sexual morality and the raising and educating of children, we should ask whether it affirms or denies the reality of marriage, whether it promotes or frustrates understanding and cooperation between the sexes, whether it springs from gratitude or resentment, from hope or despair, from materialist individualism or of one kind or another, or from the joy of membership in an embodied society. Is that do the gender-neutral toy aisles promote gratitude or resentment, hope or despair, materialist individualism, or the joy of membership in an embedded society? Which do they do? John in the Northwest Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. Doesn't requiring a gender-neutral aisle, isn't that an admission that boys and girls are different?
No. They would argue, I suppose, that boys and girls have been socialized in such a way that is artificial. And so this is the way to remove those stereotypes that drive boys and girls in one direction or the other. And as the California politician who sponsored the gender-neutral toy aisle said, let kids be kids. It's just letting kids be kids. Anything goes. And that's
the way. Then, but then you don't need any gender aisle. If they're the same,
well, that's what,
just the toy department.
Thanks for the call, John. Well, that's sort of what they're saying, but is that true? And, I mean, just observationally, parents, do you notice any difference between your sons and your daughters? Do you notice any difference in your friendships with women, if you're a woman, versus your friendships with men? Is there anything different with those dynamics? Biological and anthropological, but I mean just biological because that's easy to observe. No, it's all the same? It's just a false construct that has been imposed by the patriarchy? Is that what's happening? And this is the way to topple the patriarchy and these ersatz stereotypes? Steve on the South Side.
Hey, Dan and Amy. You know, one of the main things is I would put blame on heterosexual relationships as well because of the selfishness that we see in it, right? And it's a take, and you're here to serve me, you're here to do whatever, and not necessarily an investment in each other. And so they teach their kids this foolishness, throughout their own lives, and then all of a sudden they go away saying, oh, well, I'm only going to get who I want. And if that means multiple partners until I find it, then that's what it's going to be. If that means it's going to be the same sex, then what it is. And so to your point, no, we can't build a society like that, and we will not ever grow a society because it'll stop eventually, right? Procreation stops. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's really on the family itself.
Thanks for the call, Steve. Do women, girls who were weaned on girls' toys and boys who are weaned on boys' toys, does a kid, a boy who played with G.I. Joe, can he grow up to be and has, that's this actually occurred, a nurse or, as you were talking about, a cook, a chef? Yeah. Obviously now in the era of celebrity chefs, it's extolled, but but pick a teacher, pick professions that are traditionally dominated by women and say, well, is there something about raising boys with a recognition they're boys that prevents them from pursuing a career path, pursuing any career path? Same thing for girls. Is there something about growing up and being raised to understand what it means to be a girl and a woman that prevents a woman from being an airline pilot or serving in the military or, you know, again, areas, professions typically dominated by men? Is this a solution in search of a problem? I mean, I guess the problem is biological and anthropological reality, and so it's a solution in search of remedying that problem, in quotation marks, if you think that's a problem.
Not a problem.
And what problems right. does it beget if you choose that path? Steve and Niles.
Times have never changed. When the kids are in kindergarten, it's a fact. The boys and girls don't know any better. They play with each other's girly toys and a boy that it's all the times haven't changed, but I'll tell you something, when the guys get to be teenagers, watch out, girls, because we're gonna play with your toys.
Okay, all right. Wow, very lively, Steve from Niles. Thank you.
Thinking about teenage girls, apparently.
I want to hear from Tony in Downers Grove.
Well, you're not going to. Maida in Lake in the Hills.
That's rude.
Hey, Dan and Amy, I love you guys so much. So, first of all, to answer your question earlier about can a society thrive with just having everything gender neutral, well, George Gilder would say no. And when you were asking these questions, it made me think about a book that he wrote a long time ago called Men and Marriage, and the preface is The Princess and the Barbarian. And it's fabulous. If you haven't read it, it's a bit of an allegory, but it's just superb, showing the difference between men and women. And if the princess cannot tame the barbarian, then you will have a society where there's lawlessness. But it also talks about if there are no barbarians to be tamed, you have princesses who also cannot create a thriving economy. And by having a princess and a barbarian together, working together, you end up with forests that are tamed, houses that are built, economies that thrive. So I think that this whole problem that people have talked about for a long time, the feminization of men, the masculinization of women, that what we see today happening is let's just not fix it. Let's not solve it. Let's just pretend it doesn't exist and explain it away. And the easiest way is let's just not even have male and female.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Maida, and the George Gilder reference. Everything George Gilder writes is
get rid of pronouns.
Yeah.
You
so,
people.
Right. The sentimental barbarians, one and all. As opposed to, as Maida was saying, women as a civilizing force in society, which is what we used to understand about one of the roles that women play, civilizing force. Is that no longer true? Is that no longer needed? Eric and Munster.
Hey, good morning. First time caller. Been listening for a couple months now. I've really enjoyed it.
Great.
I'm a father and just trying to find toys now when I shop online, which we've been pushed to do with the situation we have. They've been going on. But there's a lot of stores now where I'm finding it's hard to find toys for, you know, birthdays and Christmas by gender because they're just trying to make everything generic now. So it's making it more difficult for parents. And it seems just to make a few people happy that it's there. They're making it everything inconvenient for the rest of us.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's a recurring theme, isn't it? Thanks for the call, Eric. And it's not just to make a few people happy. It's to advance a particular ideological disposition of a few people. That's what it's really happened. I mean, so I guess that by extension makes them happy if your kids are indoctrinated to be these non-binary Marxists. Tony in Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for letting me on.
Sure, no problem. Amy wanted you so badly
that
I had to do it.
I'm thinking you shot like a 79 or an 80 over the weekend, and you're not happy.
something like that.
Smoked cigars while he was doing it. Yes, go on, Tony. What's up?
No, to the point that the last caller was making, which was a very good point, but it's how they're doing it. So I got suspended again from Facebook for 30 days because I responded to a string that was all about a high school boy that was just crowned homecoming queen in Orlando, Florida. And there was one person on the string that kept on insisting, well, it's she. And the point that this person was making was all the classmates voted for this person. And I said, well, I'm sure that they weren't afraid of facing any repercussions if they didn't go along with it by the 6 or 3 or 2% that was going to be vocal. And that's part of it. And some of the responses were interesting from anywhere from a mom saying, I said, I'd like to be a fly on the wall for the parents whose son is going to date that homecoming queen. And one woman said, I would have no problem with that. It's acceptance at all levels. And as you said, it doesn't just start, it starts with the toys and then it just filters on up. And then you get to she is a homecoming queen. And isn't that great? And we should just accept it because it doesn't harm anyone. And it does. Specifically, the person who is pretending that they're a she and getting crowned.
Well, the people voted for him.
Thanks, Tony.
But still voted for him, her. But we're not even going to have homecoming king and queen. I mean, there's high schools, Buffalo Grove, they're not doing it. Downers Grove North, they're going to call them representatives next year instead of homecoming king and queen. It's just ridiculous.
How about Sentimental Barbarian 1 and 2?
That would be better.
Holly in St. Louis.
Hey, I know you're running out of time. I just have one word, rambunctious. I think that this all started to go downhill about 15 years ago when I started noticing kids who had been rambunctious boys in school suddenly started showing up in like a drugged haze. And in Boys Adrift, the author talks about this. We're just drugging the masculinity out of young boys and making them comply. We've taken tag out of recess. We are doing everything we can to not encourage rambunctious masculinity, and the society will pay. And you can go online right now and you can order a Defend Masculinity shirt because that is my new cause. We need men.
Yes.
Thanks for the call, Holly. Appreciate that. And great Leonard Sachs reference. We're on the same wavelength because we're going to have Leonard Sachs on the show in the coming days.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
All right, listen up. Judson University's World Leaders Forum is returning, headlined this year by foreign policy expert and retired General David Petraeus, who served as a commander of the U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan and later as the director of the CIA. General Petraeus will be with AM 560's Mark Vargas, host of Mark My Words, heard Sundays here at 7 p.m. Tickets start at $50 for veterans, $75 for general admission, and are available with all the details at judsonu.org. AM560.edu/WLF. For a limited time, you have the opportunity to win a pair of tickets from AM560 to join General David Petraeus and Mark Vargas. Enter to win today at 560theanswer.com and search for the keyword leaders.
Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield, they are, Amy?
Ben and Jerry's?
Ben and Jerry's, that's
yes,
who they are.
They live in Vermont. I went to their, if an ice cream doesn't work out, they have a ice cream cemetery there. It's fascinating, really fun thing to do if you ever go to Vermont.
Yeah, I think the $300 million they made selling the company Unilever probably ensures things are going to work out for them. Ben and Jerry recently did an interview I saw on this Twitter feed I started following, The First on TV, which is pretty good, sort of like trying to elevate new voices and including new reporters to new interviews, which is nice because the stuff on cable news networks is pretty tiresome. So this young reporter pressed Ben Cohen on their boycotting of Israel over policy disagreements. No Ben and Jerry's for you in Israel. Well, okay. So why boycott Israel and why not boycott some of the states here in America where you have similar policy disagreements? And she completely befuddles Ben Cohen. It is delicious, if you will, to watch.
If you disagree with the Israeli government policy, why not just stop sales completely?
Well, I disagree with the U.S. policy. We couldn't stop selling in the U.S. I think it's fine to be involved with a country, to be a citizen of a country, and to protest some of the country's actions. And that's essentially what we're doing in terms of Israel. We hugely support Israel's right to exist, but we are against a particular policy.
You guys are big proponents of voting rights. Why do you still sell ice cream in Georgia? Texas, abortion bans. Why are you still selling there?
I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question. I don't know what that would accomplish. We're working on those issues of voting rights and...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think you ask a really good question, and I think
I don't know.
I'd have to sit down and think about it for a bit.
Here, let me help you, Ben.
Yeah.
Unilever makes us. That would be too much of a price to pay. You see, young lady, we're only interested in doing things like supporting the BDS movement against Israel because it's popular in the circles that we want to be popular in, and because it doesn't impose much of a cost on us. We only want to take this principled stand business so far, you understand? And
right.
Hypocrisy is part of the attributes that we enjoy as leftist intelligentsia, you see. That's great. A question he never contemplated. They're so blind to their own hypocrisy, they wouldn't even contemplate having to answer a question somebody might pose about it. And so you're made to look like a complete buffoon, which Ben Cohen is intellectually, by this junior reporter from The First on TV. Wonderful. Wonderful job, young lady. Jason Hill joins us now. He's a professor of philosophy at DePaul University, author of the book We Have Overcome. Jason, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan, for having me.
You've written a lot about Israel as well, and sort of the intersection of Israel, the American left, our purge culture that's going on at the hands of neo-Jacobins like Ben and Jerry. Your reaction?
Well, I mean, the way I would put it is that cancel culture is universal, and seemingly disparate movements have one thing in common. What they want to really do is cancel Western civilization, and they want to cancel history. The fact that they're very selective about Israel shows their moral hypocrisy and their sort of inconsistency in the application of their principles. But the principals really, at the end of the day, have one goal, which is to obliterate anything that serves the interests of capitalism, serves the interests of America, and serves the interests of Western civilization. And that is their primary goal. That's why you can see disparate movements like Black Lives Matter and the LGBTQ movement and Students for Justice in Palestine and Antifa and all sorts of movements that would, on the surface, seem not to have anything in common except one single premise, that is their hatred of Israel, their hatred of America, coming together in their joint venture to cancel this country and to cancel Western civilization in general.
But not before we get ours, say Ben and Jerry and so many of the champagne socialists. Not before we get ours. We still get ours, right?
We still get ours, yeah. Because of course they want the accoutrements and they want the fringe. I call them the fringe benefit. But I just call that sort of journalistic minutia and really just moral hypocrisy that they really haven't thought out through. On the part of their public relations managers, really.
Yeah, no, I know. But it's so telling because, I mean, these are the self-styled individuals that are charting a course for a better tomorrow in America, so they tell us.
Well, we're not. And we see it in the inconsistency of the application of their so-called principles. They're not charting a better course for America. They're paying unconscionable lip service to that viewpoint. But they're all destroyers of this great civilization and destroyers of Western civilization in general.
I wanted to get your reaction to the most recent cancellation on campus, not because it's so unique, but because no less than a contributor to The Atlantic took notice of it and describes it as something qualitatively different than what's been happening. And I'm not sure about that. It's the story of Dorian Abbott, who's a geophysicist at University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. You probably know it. Of course, you know it. You're familiar with being accosted on campus. I'm sure you're following this. But he was invited to give a lecture at MIT on his work on climate change. And
right.
And people, some of the best and brightest to MIT. Found out that he is not on board with DIE, diversity, inclusion, and equity. He advocates instead what he calls merit, fairness, and equality. I'll see your DIE and I'll raise you an MFE, basically, merit, fairness, and equality, through which applicants are treated as individuals evaluated through a rigorous and unbiased process based on their merit and qualifications alone. Radical stuff from Dorian Abbott. But because of the statements he made in furtherance of that belief, there was an uprising on campus. You have to cancel him. You can't allow him to speak. And MIT ultimately acquiesced. And as often happens, he was allowed to give a talk to a smaller select group of people in a smaller venue that was not so public facing so as to generate the heat that the students were prepared to generate if he was in, if the commitment to the invitation had been abided. Is this something really that different than what has been happening for literally decades on college campuses? Or is it just those who like to think of themselves as small L liberals when it comes to dialogue and free speech on campus, you know, make selective choices about people being persecuted and say, well, this guy was going to talk about climate change. He's an important person on this issue. He's a geophysicist, University of Chicago. So we need to have his scholarship. And so this is somebody we can't cancel. And they're trying to draw lines after all the lines have been erased.
No, this is something that has gotten increasingly worse. I mean, I have seen just in the past 2 years where it's the primacy of feelings of the primacy of feelings and the primacy of emotion as unassailable givens that are unanswerable to reason, evidence, and logical argumentation. And so what has become increasingly more common is for students to register their protest, not through reasoned debate, turning up to a speaker whose views that whose views differs from yours, and you sort of politely and in a civil manner raise your objections, but through this kind of primitive, savage display of emotions and feelings. It's almost a kind of these students have turned into feral creatures, And that display of ferality and the display of emotions are taken as unassailable givens, and university administrators have increasingly capitulated to those feelings as unassailable givens and use them as the means to adjudicate between or among truth claims. So this is not something that I saw even on my campus when 8 years ago. I think this is a phenomenon that has got increasingly worse as cancel culture, as the relativism, as student activism has started to replace scholarship. In my own university, I see where the honors program, for example, has imported a kind of activism into the curriculum, like take a stand, you know, on Black Lives Matter or the hashtag MeToo movement, whereas the honors program used to be a bastion. It used to be like a secular church of old-fashioned scholarship. And you find this happening increasingly on most universities where activism becomes a component of scholarship, a big component of scholarship. That gives the student license to sort of disrupt speeches or talks that they disagree with. But this, to answer your question, this is becoming increasingly worse. And, you know, in my forthcoming book that's coming out, What Do White Americans Owe Black People?, I spent a lot of time, you know, talking about the roots and the origins of this phenomenon. The chickens have come home to roost. It started back in the 1960s with the rise of these fake disciplines like Black studies and queer studies and post-colonial studies and Chicano studies and all kind of women's studies and gender studies, fake disciplines that were nothing but activist studies and revolutionary studies that attacked Western civilization, reason, and logic. And now the chickens have come home to roost, and we're seeing the manifestations of its ugliness.
This is sort of the solidarity and marginality movement, as Rusty Reno describes it. You segregate for the purpose of unifying, and it seems to be a contradiction in terms. But they do have a commonality, and that commonality is basically Marxism.
No, that's right, Dan. And it's not only Marxism. I was just reading Leon Trotsky's The Permanent Revolution, which I keep on my desk because it's Marxism, and it's a permanent revolution that can never end, no matter how many of the demands are met. I mean, in my book that's coming out on What Do White Americans Owe Black People, I talk about post-oppression. We are living in a post-oppressed society. Blacks are not oppressed in the way that they were prior to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And gays and lesbians since the 2015 Marital Act are certainly not oppressed in the way that they were or had their individual rights denied. But the revolution has to be a permanent one until all persons are eviscerated of their agency, until their confidence and their means of issuing a no, issuing objections are completely erased. And, you know, then you have the means of implementing what I call a new eugenic program, which is what cancel culture and woke culture are all about. It's a massive eugenic program to re-socialize the sensibilities of young people, to usher in a Marxist socialist money law. Let me just say, what is really socialism? It's a money laundering, Ponzi scheming, legalized theft program by the government. You know, I think the left, the conservatives should really start calling socialism what it really is. It's a money laundering program that appropriates money from without people's permission from them.
That's a great description.
It's a Ponzi scheming money laundering program. And that's what they're after.
I mean, just since you have, suffered so many slings and arrows during your time at DePaul University, update us from the last time we spoke. What is campus life like for you at that anti-Catholic Catholic school?
Well, fortunately, I don't have to be there. I'm still teaching online. I have been teaching online since the pandemic started in March of 2020, and I taught online in the spring. I'm on sabbatical right now, writing another book and writing a lot of articles, and then I'll be teaching online in the winter. So I'll probably go back in person on spring, but I'm still persona non grata. There are about two people on campus who will speak to me, and there's still a boycott against me. I mean, I teach four classes teach four classes and there are only two students in each of the class, may I just say that those four classes would normally have attracted 40 students in each class, and I would have had two teaching assistants for each of those classes. I have four students among two classes.
Amy, cross DePaul off the list for Peyton and Eli, please.
Done.
Yeah.
That is ridiculous. Well, who's telling the students not to sign up for classes?
Well, it's a boycott led by the students and the faculty together. Okay. When I was censured a long time ago, 2 years ago.
Right, I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Jason Hill, he is a philosophy professor at DePaul. If you haven't picked up his book, We Have Overcome, An Immigrant's Love Letter to America, do that. And his forthcoming book, What White Americans Owe Black Americans, as you were just describing, there's an excellent blurb I know on the jacket of that book that you want to make sure to read too, Amy, when you pick that up.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a blurb from me.
Oh.
Yeah, excellent blurb from the great Dan Proft.
I don't have the chops to write a book, but I can write a pretty, pretty good blurb, and that's okay. The extent of my ability. Jason Hill, thanks so much for joining us, as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.